We ready? All right. All right. Good morning, everyone. Lovely morning in the North State. Welcome to the 601st board meeting of the California Regional Water Quality Control Board, Central Valley Region, located in Sacramento. This meeting is of the Central Valley Regional Water Quality Control Board is called to order at 9:06 a.m. on Friday, October the 10th, and a quorum of the board is present. The meeting is being live streamed, and a full video will be available on YouTube following this meeting. I am Nick Abdus, the chair of the Central Valley Water Board, and I will introduce the other board members in just a minute. All right. So, Courtney, can you please begin by providing instructions for members of the public that plan on participating in today's meeting?
Good morning, everyone. My name is Courtney Kasich, and I'm sitting in for the clerk of the board. I'll begin by sharing some information about how public participation will be organized for today's meeting. If you wish to make a verbal comment on one of the board items or during the public forum, you must be attending either in person, through Zoom platform, or by calling in via phone. If you are currently watching the webcast on CalSPAN but would like to make a comment, please email me now at agenda5@waterboards.ca.gov. to request the Zoom link. If you are already on the Zoom webinar and wish to speak but have not registered, please raise your hand and you'll be called on. If you are using a computer or tablet, click the Raise Hand button. If you are calling in by phone, press *9 to raise your hand. Generally, in-person commenters will be called on first, followed by Zoom and phone participants. If you are here in person and wish to speak but haven't completed a blue comment card and given it to a staff member, or if you are on Zoom and haven't raised your hand, you may miss your opportunity to speak. Staff will call each commenter by name, and your microphone will be unmuted. If you are calling in by phone, staff will identify you by the last three digits of your phone number. For the record, please state your name and who you are representing before speaking. This is especially important for those testifying on an item. Unless you have been granted additional time, each speaker will have 3 minutes. A bell will sound when your time is up. Please speak from a quiet location to minimize background noise. And finally, a friendly reminder to our board members, presenters, and staff. Please mute yourself when not speaking to reduce background noise, and if possible, keep your camera on when speaking. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Courtney. I will now introduce the other board members quickly. Elena Lee Reeder to my left of Sacramento, Mark Bradford of Sacramento, also my left, Denise Gadara of Allensworth to my right, Sean Yang to my far left from Sacramento, Art Baggett from El Portal to my far right, and of course, I'm Nick Abdus from Sacramento. Nicole Morgan is here this morning. Thank you, Nicole, member of the State Water Board, and is participating in this meeting and will provide a little bit of an update in a little bit in the agenda. I will now introduce the Executive Officer, Patrick Palupa, who will in turn introduce his staff. But before we do that, I would like all of us to stand for the Pledge of Allegiance, please.
Salute and pledge. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the republic to which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good morning, Chair Abdus, members of the board. Like once again to thank the City of Reading for hosting this meeting, as it has done many times before. And certainly all of the folks who contributed to the trip yesterday to see the headwaters of Sacramento and many other areas that the board regulates upstream of Sacramento. Let me introduce some of my senior staff and attorneys here. To my far left is Adam Lappitz, Assistant Executive Officer in the Rancho Cordova office. You've already heard from Courtney Kasich, who I'm very grateful that she's pinch-hitting as the board's clerk today and has done a fantastic job helping arrange this meeting. To my immediate right is Jessica Yar from the Office Chief Counsel. To her right, Clint Snyder, Assistant Executive Officer who runs the board's Reading office and to his immediate right, Christina Shoup, who runs the board's Fresno office. With that, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you for that, Patrick. At this point in the meeting, we'd like to call out any board member communications. Anyone? Go ahead, Sean.
Well, I just wanted to say I too was very impressed and appreciative of Clint and his team for taking us on a tour yesterday. And I enjoyed it very much so, and was very pleased to see the Mount Shasta water spring that plays a part of making up the Sacramento River. So I really appreciate it. So I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Elena? Hi, I'm Elena Lee Reeder here. October 3rd, I attended the chair's meeting at Cal EPA with board, with Patrick Palupa.
Good morning. On the 3rd of September, we had a site visit from the Integrated Climate Adaptation and Resiliency Program Technical Advisory Council staff to visit Allensworth in preparation for a meeting they will be doing in Allensworth on the 24th of this month. The 9th of September, ICARP, TAC, came to we hosted a meeting with them to talk about the preparations for the meeting. On the 13th of September, we had an environmental, a social justice tour by the water, education, and Latino leaders in Allensworth. On the 26th of September, we had a briefing with our executive officer regarding an update on the Cutler PUD emergency water crisis. Let's see the other item. On the 30th of September, we met with representatives from the Community Water Center to discuss Cutler PUD and the water challenges and ways to get emergency water service to them. The September 2nd, we had our board briefing. And then just to reiterate, on October 24th, the Allensworth Progressive Association will be hosting the Integrated Climate Adaptation and Resiliency Program Technical Advisory Council. It will be in Delano at the Hyatt Place Hotel. They will be discussing water issues, climate adaptation, and a lot of the programs. And Allensworth is featured because we're one of the vulnerable communities that they often speak of in prioritizing activities to address vulnerable communities. We will be sharing with them some of the activities we have underway as a vulnerable community to begin to address many of these climate changes that we face in the community. And with that, I thank you and good morning to everyone.
Thank you, Denise.
Got one more here. Hi. Good morning. I also had a conversation with Community Water Center on October 7th regarding Cutler. I think their main concern was the lack of a water station, although that's in the works. And meanwhile, the communication to residents doesn't seem to be generating a lot of interest for bottled water. So the request was basically to put a little more pressure on the King's Water Alliance to get communications out any way they can to people who are eligible for bottled water delivery. And that was it for me.
One more comment. I really want to just thank the staff, Clint, and all of the staff in the Reading office, our Fresno office, and Rancho Cordova office for the tour yesterday. It was very enlightening, from the headwater to the wastewater treatment facilities to the trout hatchery to the restoration of the lake, and just the wonderful education we get as board members to understand the work that goes into everything that you do. It's very important. It's very educational for us. It's beneficial for us as we go about trying to make the right decisions to protect water quality and residents in our state. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Denise. All right. Anyone else? Okay, moving on. Next item, State Water Board Liaison Update. So Nicole Morgan is here to provide an update. Nicole, come on down.
Thank you. All right, good morning. I'm not sure if I will ever get used to this room. It is always a, interesting setup. So good morning, Chair Abbas and members of the board. It is wonderful to join you this morning, and thank you for allowing me to join you yesterday on the tour. It was a great adventure, and with just being a native Northern Californian and just, you know, being able to get out and see different areas of the state that I have not been able to enjoy and to see before is always a great experience. So thank you. So let's see here. We have a few things going on with the State Board, as always. I'm going to give you a few updates. Apologize that I am a little out of breath here this morning, just recovering a little bit. So I'm going to take my time walking through this.
Take all the time you need, Nicole.
Okay, so I am sure you all heard that on September 16th, the State Board rescinded the August 22nd, 2025, second revised notice of opportunity for public comment and hearing on the revised draft Sacramento Delta updates for the water quality control plan for the San Francisco Bay Delta, Sacramento San Joaquin Delta watershed. So that's a lot of words. So basically, the Bay Delta plan. The rescinded notice is available on the board's website. Accordingly, the hearing previously scheduled for September 24th and 25th and the associated public comment period are canceled and will be rescheduled to a future date. Updating the Sacramento Delta components of the Bay Delta plan is one of the state's water board's top priorities. The board is working expeditiously to complete this update. Board staff anticipate a limited recirculation of the draft staff report, substitute environmental document, in support of the Sacramento Delta updates to the Bay Delta plan, together with the updated draft plan in December 2025. New dates for a public hearing and comment period will be announced upon release. So once we know, you'll know. let's see here. So the next two items are under ex parte. I cannot answer questions, but just did want to provide you with a brief update. On September 12th, the AHO, so Administrative Hearing Office, released the seventh amended hearing notice for the Delta Conveyance Project hearings. The public hearings will continue on September 29th, continued on September 29th and 30th, and throughout October. Time is flying here. We are well into October already. More information can be found on the project website. The site's reservoir project on September 15th, site's project authority submitted a water quality certification application for construction of the site's project. And the Clean Water Act Section 404 permit application was submitted concurrently to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. The water quality certification application starts a one-year clock for the State Board to act on the water quality certification application. So, next subject, one that is very much so dear to me, the wastewater needs assessment. The wastewater needs assessment group began meeting in July of 2024 and has since met quarterly. The next quarterly meeting will be held on October 24th, which aligns significant project milestone as the project team transitions from the evaluation of the baseline conditions of wastewater infrastructure services in California, so that's going to be phase one, to an empirical analysis of system-wide needs to solution costs that help provide a long-term pathway for the provision of more equitable sanitation services in California, including a roadmap for ongoing assessment beyond the contract term, which is phase two. The October 24th meeting, the group will provide the opportunity for open discussion regarding phase one of the report. So just in other words, in phase one, the group really just looked at, hey, what data is out there? Let's look at the data. Let's do a gap assessment. Let's pull all that data together, see what we have, and let's create, how do we move forward with all this data? What is it that we're going to define the world of wastewater needs in California? As far as wastewater systems, it's a little bit different than when you look at traditional drinking water systems. We have the really large facilities. You scale up the facility that we went to, Yesterday, the Mount Shasta facility, from a, you know, it's a treasury system. We have the treasury systems that go much larger than that. And we have all the way, all everything you could think of in between, down to individual septic systems. And really looking at how do we find out what each individual household, how is it served? And looking at, so, you know, what information do we have on each of these? Which can be difficult because the individual systems, the state board, the regional boards, the water boards do not regulate. They're under counties. And so really looking at, you know, while we do have programs that work with counties, we don't know the world of all of the systems. And then also within our databases, we have a lot of information. They're in several different databases in several different forms. And really looking at bringing all of that together and being able to evaluate it to see where are our critical wastewater needs are and how do we assist communities as we are with now with drinking water, how do we assist them with our sanitary needs? Because it is equally as critical that we provide sanitary needs to all communities. And where we can, you know, do we regionalize? Do we connect them to a neighbor? Do we look at managerial, providing support? Those that are on septic, you know, how do we address that with failing septic systems? So a lot of questions out there. And then also, you know, and so we're doing, you know, first of a kind that is being happened within the U.S., and so we're really leading the way in this, working with UMass, and they are actually have a, I'm going to call it a model, where they are looking at all of California, and they inputted all the information we have on all the systems, and they are able to, like, run it and then determine, hey, here's a pocket that doesn't have a system, and we're able to say, oh, you know, there is homes here. So there's probably septic here, and we are able to reach out and get more information. So in the end, we'll be able to really understand the world of wastewater within California and be able to more proactively reach out to communities and really work with them and have a holistic look of where we've come, what we have accomplished, and more importantly, where do we need to go to fill those gaps and to get out to communities and really work with them on their current needs and their future needs. So for me, this is really exciting. It's the, what I call the, you know, it's the below ground, the area of our infrastructure that no one wants to talk about, no one wants to see. There's many that is going right. And then there's places that where it's not going right. And so really being able to get out there and to assess what is going really well, highlight what's going well, what is working, share and learn from our neighbors. And, you know, those counties that are doing great with their septic, how is it being managed and operated and going great? And share that with the counties that perhaps it's not going as well. And in some areas, perhaps septic is just not the solution because of the area that you're in and where your groundwater is, the underlying, and making sure that also we are in turn protecting our drinking water sources. So this is really exciting for me, working through this. And with this, you know, the first phase one reports will be coming out, I'm going to say later this year, probably by the end of the year, and they'll be moving into the phase two, and really that's where you really start digging in and getting the, where are we going with this project? So phase two is going to be exciting, so stay tuned. Ag expert panel, you guys know what's going on, you're going to have more information later, so I'm going to skip on over that. Office of Operator Certification Program, on October 20th, the Wastewater Operator Certification Programs will hold the semi-annual advisory meetings in the Cal EPA building. This meeting is attended by water industry professionals and provides opportunity for their input and feedback on all topics concerning the program. Also, just a great convening of bringing operators together to really talk about where the gaps are, what is needed, talk about the regulations and how we really get more operators into certification, make sure that our exams are where they need to be, just the our regulations, if there's anything that needs to be adjusted, just have those great conversations with industry, making sure that we're engaging on all levels. Let's see here. The last one was the Wildfire Resiliency Program update. On behalf of California Environmental Protection Agency, staff continue to collaborate with the California Natural Resource Agency to implement the March 1st, 2025 state emergency proclamation to fast-track critical fuels reduction projects. Staff have reviewed and facilitated approval of over 100 projects, a major milestone highlight at California Wildfire and Forest Resilient Task Force meeting on September 4th. Eligible projects would apply by December 31st using application available on the Wildfire Resiliency Task Force webpage. And I apologize, I did have something else I did want to bring up to you all. On water rights, the updating water right data for California upward project. So a big project that has been going on within water rights is really updating their database system. Did get to go on and see some of the things that are live. It's really exciting. October 7th, the division launched its new, the system is up. It is live. We were going to have a board meeting to really do the official launch. We postponed that to October 14th. But the system is live. They have been working with stakeholders to go in to test the system, to look at any bugs and tweaks. We had a previous system, eRIMS. It was outdated. And so they have been looking at it, updating our water rights. If you had taken a look and you needed information, you really did walk into a library and you checked out volumes. And for each water right, it was 2-3 inch thick of paper. It went back to, 50, 70 years worth of records. That's what you had to go through. They've been working on digitizing those records. That is still ongoing. And along with that, not only digitizing all those records, but you can now go online and you can see a map of California. And you can see all the water rights and their points and their sources of where they are pulling out their point of diversion. And you can then click on that, and you can pull up the information. And so just really amazing work by Eric Ekdahl and his team. And so they are just still working through a little bit and refining it. So our next board meeting in 2 weeks, they're going to do the official announcement and go through and show the public just how that is working and do a demonstration. But there is already information, and you can already go as a member of the public to the board's website, and you can already go and start clicking around and seeing some information. I was able to go do that and really was impressed by the work that has occurred, and just being a person who was a staff in water rights and used the old system, and now being a board member and having to go through things as a member of public a different way, I have to say that this is quite this is quite amazing work that staff have done, and just being able to go on a computer and pull up all that information that you really did have to go and have paper and click through, and it was quite tedious. And if you can imagine those records, it was one piece of paper. If that one piece of paper got lost, that's the record. So they are scanning tens of thousands of documents and getting those all in, making it available to everyone within California. So really, getting our water rights system transparent. So I wanted to make sure, especially being here in Reading, that I did highlight that and let you all know that that was coming to our next board meeting. So with that, that will conclude my report. Here for questions.
Thank you, Nicole. That was a mouthful. Go ahead, Patrick.
I was going to say, I really want to thank you for mentioning the operator certification and the problem solving that's going on in that area. When I was at the CivicWell conference recently, I had a chance to hear Keisha Kelly talk about that program. The way that they are using analytics to identify needs, identify the way the exams are working and not working, I think is really, really cool. It's so in the weeds, but I think making sure that we have a pipeline for operators to come into the system, recognizing the need in the wastewater community for the board's benefit. It is really tough for small communities to maintain a wastewater operator, and so critical to making sure that our waters are protected. I just really want to thank you for highlighting that. It's something that I hear kind of in back channels that the need is very much there, and it's great to hear that we've got a team. Stateport has a team that's working on it and trying to use analytics to figure out where we can best apply pressure or make things a little easier for some of those communities.
And so you gave me that opening, so that, you know, wastewater geek here. So the Operator Certification Program, in my previous role, I oversaw the management of that program, and it was during COVID, and we recognized that our exams were only provided two times a year on paper. And so we had paper exams two times a year. You had to go to a big facility. We had to rent these facilities. Everyone had to go. If you missed that time, and, you know, a lot of time off of work for the operators to come and take these exams. So they only had those two times a year, one time in Northern California, one time in Southern California. And those are their only opportunities to promote, you know, to take the next grade up. There's grades 1 through 5. Actually 5 is an oral exam. We're working on that. So there's these two times a year. That was it. COVID hits. Well, we had to cancel exams. So now there's zero opportunity to grow in your career. That was, you know, for me, unthinkable of a critical role within our world, you know, the water world here, water quality. And so State Board actually gave us, I'm going to say, a challenge to, can we look at digitizing the exams basically within 1 year? That's not something that usually occurs to move that quickly of paper exams where you have multiple different ones and to move to a fully computer-based testing. So we took on that challenge, and we actually succeeded. And so we changed over to computer-based testing with testing centers that would make sure that we still have the security intact, where individuals can go to a testing center throughout the state at any point. They just had to make an appointment. And at any point, they can go make an appointment to a testing center, show their ID. Well, once they apply to us, make sure that they had all their qualifications. We approve them. Once State Board approved them for their exam, that's now Keisha Kelly's program. Once they're approved for their exam, that information is in the database. They apply to the test. They apply for an appointment for the testing center. They can go at any time of their convenience within the testing center, within an hour from their home, from their job. They can go to that testing center. The testing center goes through all of the making sure that they have their ID, they have everything. They lock away all, you know, anything they're not supposed to have from their tests, make sure all the security, all the protocols are taken care of. And they sit there and they can go on the computer and they can take their tests and they can get their results back a lot faster than the paper coming back to the State Board. And I was one of those people who would sit there and grade and go through all of the paper exams. Now that's all done on the computer and they get their results back a lot faster. So it really has, I want to say expedited, but it really has improved our system. Now Keisha's team is able to use that information and the analytics to make sure that the questions that we're asking are the right questions. That, you know, our pass-fail rates, are they within an accessible industry guideline? And, you know, are we doing the best for our industry? And so it just... You know, when you talk about silver linings of the pandemic, this is really one that where we really took on a challenge, and the team, Keisha's team, has really ran with that and have been working with the industry to really improve how we bring operators in and making sure that we are testing for the right things and are bringing along the most qualified people to do the jobs, but then also making sure that we are able to continue to get that pipeline in, because we have increased the opportunities and made it a lot simpler for people to come in and take those exams.
Thank you, Nicole. Anybody have any questions or comments? Yes, Denise.
Thank you, Nicole, for your presentation today. And I'm also very appreciative of the Water Operators Certification Program. It's actually beginning to help in rural communities where there's a need. And with the water operators, many of them aging and ready to step out, we do need a pipeline of people to come in. And so I think the work that's happened to help expedite the testing and the results and all of that is going to make a huge difference for communities that really stand in need of having water operators and to be able to move that process a lot faster. And then I also wanted to just acknowledge the wastewater needs assessment, how critical it is for, you know, just for what you said, to help us see where the problems are, where we need to make some improvements, how we begin to graduate from the septic to the sewer, all of those things I think is very, very important. And the only question I had for that was, will there be any priorities in that needs in the needs assessment for those vulnerable communities and funding? I mean, because we can do all the needs assessments, but if the dollars don't go where it's needed most, so I'm just curious as if that's a part of the process that will include the most vulnerable communities as a priority.
Yes, and so definitely the team will be recommending priorities to mm-hmm. the state board, and with the it will come with similar to how the drinking water mm-hmm. is taking a look at different variables mm-hmm. and making sure that we're working through those variables, and then highlighting the systems that are the most vulnerable mm-hmm. as our priority. Mm-hmm. Funding is always a question. We're hopeful that as we did on the drinking water side, by highlighting where there is a need and what that and quantifying that need, there will come funding. Mm-hmm. And so we're hopeful and following, you know, working with the administration and following that road that has been set by the drinking water needs assessment.
Okay. All right, and last, since you're up there as a state board member, I spoke about our staff in the tour yesterday, but I also wanted to acknowledge the state board staff. They did a tremendous job in presenting all the different programs yesterday on the tour, and we really appreciate the hard work that went into it from everybody that participated, but I also wanted to acknowledge the state board staff. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Any other board member? All right. Thank you, Nicole, very much.
And thank you all.
All right. Next on the agenda, we have a public forum. This is for any comments on items not on the agenda. If you're a person at the meeting who wishes to speak and have not submitted a speaker card, please fill out a blue card at the reception table and give it to a staff member. If you're on Zoom and wish to speak but I'm not registered, please raise your hand now. Courtney, do we have any request to speak on items not on the agenda?
No.
Okay.
No, we do not.
All right. Thank you. Do we have? Did I see a hand raised back there? Okay. Please come up to the podium, and you can fill out a card afterwards. So, or is there somebody online? Okay. Can we go ahead and call the, okay.
We have Bruce Haldeschelt.
Haldeschelt.
Yeah. Bruce, mm-hmm. welcome.
Yeah, welcome. Yeah, thank you very much. Traditionally, this has been the time in which the upper watersheds have had an opportunity to come to the Reading meeting. I want to thank you for all the work you've done for and the staff has done for a decade or so to recognize that the upper watersheds of the Sacramento Valley are much like the area you traveled to yesterday. I had hoped to join you. My car would have actually taken me further north to Oregon, where my in-laws live, but you got to see a beautiful part of the base of the region, and NACWA very much gets involved in fish issues and aquatic life and things like that. So, and you evidently threaded a needle, because I suspect the next time people travel past Shasta, it might be a little bit whiter. The weather's getting cooler. But I did want to thank you for all the work you've done in the past on the upper watersheds. And thank you for taking the time to travel to a part of the state that, you know, like El Dorado or Napa, the Pope Valley of Napa, kind of looks like portions of the Sacramento Valley. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce. Next commenter.
Kaya Rivers.
Hello, good morning. My name is Kaya Rivers, and I'm a senior policy advocate at Community Water Center. Community Water Center is a community-based organization that works alongside directly impacted communities to advocate for just water policies. And Cutler is a disadvantaged community in the San Joaquin Valley and is also part of the Agua Coalition, which is a coalition consisting of 53 members from 34 directly impacted communities, all dedicated to securing safe, clean, and affordable drinking water. I last elevated Cutler's drinking water needs in April this year, as Cutler has endured nitrate contamination for nearly a decade. And the PUD is working towards a long-term solution to mitigate the contamination. However, residents still don't have safe drinking water until the solution is complete. Because of the nitrate contamination, Cutler PUD customers do not have access to affordable drinking water and are paying twice for the rate of water by both buying bottled water and also for paying their water bill for water they cannot drink. As shared before, Cutler is a disadvantaged community and cannot afford to pay water to pay for water twice. King's Water Alliance is now offering bottled water to pregnant residents and children under the age of one, which is a good step forward, but leaves the majority of the community vulnerable to nitrate contamination. King's Water Alliance is also constructing a drinking water kiosk in Arosi, which is also another great step forward, and residents are really looking forward to when the kiosk is in operation. However, the construction of the kiosk won't be complete for another 3 to 9 months. And residents can't wait another 9 months for the kiosk to be constructed to have a safe source of drinking water. Even after the kiosk is constructed, disabled and elderly residents won't be able to transport drinking water from the kiosk to their homes. Right now, the kiosk in Dinuba is the only option for Cutler residents to access safe and affordable drinking water. And this kiosk is 7 miles away from the community, making affordable and safe drinking water difficult and inaccessible for residents who are disabled, elderly, or without transportation. Despite coordination with responsible parties, Cutler residents are still without safe drinking water and cannot wait any longer for a sustainable and accessible interim drinking water solution. We urge the regional board to coordinate with the state water board, local agencies, and stakeholders to leverage resources and provide Cutler PUD residents safe drinking water through the provision of bottled water by November until the Arosi kiosk is constructed, and extend the bottled water program to include disabled and elderly residents. Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you, Kaya. Patrick, would you like to comment relative to the
Certainly. We are working with the State Water Board. As many of you may know, the State Water Board recently issued an enforcement order to Cutler PUD to rectify some of the drinking water problems that are showing up within the community. And to bring the well that has been at least partially, if not totally funded, into compliance relatively soon. The other avenue that we are pursuing is working with King's Water Alliance. On September 4th of this year, they approved additional measures to increase both outreach and availability of both bottled water and a drinking water kiosk within, I believe, the town of Arosi, which is much closer than the 7 mile filling station that is currently available. We'll certainly keep updating the board as conditions continue to evolve, but we're on top of it. We're trying our best to make sure that we have all available water supplies being provided to folks within that community.
Thank you, Patrick. Okay, any other commenters? No?
All right, moving on to item number six, the executive officer's report. Prior to each meeting, the executive officer works with the board clerk and the board's program managers to compile a report on the status of the board's programs, its staffing, and many different initiatives the board is working on. If you're a person at the meeting wishing to speak on this item and not submitted to submit a speaker card, please do so by filling out a blue card at the reception table in the back of the room and give it to a staff member. If you're on Zoom and wish to speak, please raise your hand now. Currently, the executive officer is available to respond to questions from board members as well on the report. So, Patrick, I don't know if you have any comments relative to the report, but any questions from board members? Do we have any commenters on this item? Would you like to? Nope.
No comments on the report other than the fact that we are continuing a lot of engagement with all of our federal partners as they manage some difficult times. That includes Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, US EPA, Army Corps of Engineers, all facing unusual circumstances due to budget cutbacks and furloughs and government shutdowns and things of that nature. Thankfully, we are continuing most of our programs here at the state. Water quality is being protected. But we, you know, have some challenges working with our federal partners to make sure that all the operational systems at all their facilities and the regulations continue to be applied so that we protect water here in the Central Valley. I do have a couple of staff awards as well, but certainly available for any questions that you may have on the executive officer's report.
Go ahead and move on to the awards.
Right. Seeing none... Alex, we will present for Josh, even though he is 300 miles away. I appreciate it. We have some folks from the Fresno office who came up here. The engineer that's receiving the award this board meeting is down in Fresno, and we didn't make him come up here just to receive the award. I think that's award in and of itself. But I do want to present this to Josh Mahoney, a water resource control engineer in the board's oil field program. Oil field unit number one is essentially a permitting and enforcement program. The permits that get adopted for our program are technically complex and involve constant communication with dischargers, consultants, and the public, especially as they get close to adoption. In the past year, Josh was the lead technical staff on getting five permits or waste discharge requirements vetted, adopted, or amended, and getting several monitoring programs revised. This is a heavy lift considering that an application for a permit is often hundreds of pages long, full of highly complicated technical information, and takes months to review. During the June board meeting of the Central Valley Water Board, two permits were adopted under Josh's oversight: an amended set of waste discharge requirements and a new set of individual waste discharge requirements. This is a major accomplishment considering that the permits allow for oil field produced wastewater to irrigate crops, a subject that in the past has drawn much public attention. Josh has both the technical and communicative chops to get complicated projects like these over the finish line while keeping the public's mind at ease and protecting the environment, human health, and water quality. Thanks to Josh, both permits were adopted as uncontested, which meant getting the permits adopted efficiently and in a much shorter time frame than other permits. Getting the permits adopted as uncontested not only saves the state staff time, but also shows the public has faith in the work and expertise of our agency. The board and our unit in particular benefit greatly from Josh's regulatory knowledge, technical expertise, and dedication to his work. For these projects and all of Josh's work, he is deserving of a Superior Accomplishment Award. You've seen Josh give presentations to the board before. He's one of the best engineers within the oil field program, doing a lot of incredible work.
All right, big thank you to Josh.
Yeah. And now, a little closer to home, I do see them in the audience. Misty Pontes and Crystal Hansen are getting an award. Let's see. I'll have you come up afterwards. So we can take a picture. Crystal Hansen and Misty Pontes are jointly being recognized for their contributions to the Central Valley Water Board's Forest Activities Program. Crystal Hansen is an AGPA in the Reading Office's Non-Point Source Unit and has been with the Central Valley Water Board since 2018. Misty Pontes is an environmental scientist in the Reading Office's Non-Point Source Unit and has been with the Central Valley Water Board since 2020. Misty and Crystal are being recognized for their work overseeing a unique contract to develop a new technical online training program for the United States Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management staff. Completion of the training program is required of all agency staff implementing the Central Valley Water Board's recently adopted federal non-point source permit for the above-mentioned agencies. Misty and Crystal were instrumental in developing the contract, framing the training program, managing the contract, and providing technical materials to support each training module and working with the web support teams to bring the program to fruition. Crystal served as the contract manager and Misty the lead technical staff overseeing the content being produced. In these roles, both Crystal and Misty excelled, providing in-depth reviews of drafts and working closely with the contractors to ensure contract deliverables were met. This project required in-depth knowledge of the subjects being covered, including technical details of watercourse crossing and construction, road drainage, and general non-point source pollution control measures. It also required both to learn more about the online training platforms, including writing scripts and managing AI voiceovers, something neither probably ever thought they would need to learn. In working with the contractors, both Crystal and Misty demonstrated strong interpersonal communication skills and their ability to maintain positive and professional working relationships, even when having some difficult conversations and providing critical review and feedback. Ultimately, this project was successfully completed and resulted in the production of professional and technical training program to aid federal agency staff in implementing the board's new federal non-point source permit. The project was completed on top of Misty and Crystal's core workload, requiring prioritization and shuffling of tasks to ensure all their normal deliverables were met. Misty and Crystal are outstanding employees of the Reading office and the region as a whole. They are always ready and willing to take on new tasks, and their positive attitudes are greatly appreciated. The successful completion of this challenging project demonstrates their capabilities as well. Thank you both for your efforts on this project. Your contributions are greatly appreciated. I'll note for the board, as you've heard, there's been a lot of controversy about the federal forestry programs. These training modules can be delivered directly to Forest Service and BLM staff, enabling them to learn about a very complicated permit on a without coming into a classroom, and really enhances the boots-on-the-ground knowledge of the watercourse crossing and other BMPs that need to be employed to lessen water quality impacts. Honestly, especially with this new pressure on the federal programs, a click and learn modules produced by the state to aid the federal agencies in compliance, about as easy as it gets and about as streamlined a process as it gets. And thank you to the staff who put this together. Really, really a cool effort on their part.
Yeah, thank you, and congratulations, Misty and Crystal. Thank you.
Take a quick picture, and then we can move on with the board.
So we're going to take a picture now?
Quick picture.
All right.
Need you too.
Patrick, do you want us to go down?
All right, with that, we're moving on to item 7, approval of the minutes of the August 22nd, 2025 board meeting. Are there any edits or corrections to the meeting minutes? All right, hearing none, I'll ask for a motion to approve the minutes.
I'll move to approve the minutes.
Second.
Moved by Bradford, seconded by Yang. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
I need to abstain. I wasn't there.
Okay, so one abstention and five ayes. The ayes have it.
Aye.
All right. We need to do a roll call. All right. So, sorry. Jumping the gun, trying to move this meeting along. So just pause here for a roll call vote.
Board Member Kadara?
Yes.
Board Member Bradford?
That's okay. Yes.
Board Member Yang?
Aye.
Board Member Baggett?
Abstain.
Vice Chair Lee Reeder?
Aye.
And Chair Appis?
Aye. All right, next up is item 8, consideration of the uncontested items. So this is time and place for the public hearing to consider uncontested items 12 through 14. If we have any person in the meeting wishing to speak on these items and having not submitted a speaker card, please fill one out at the back of the room and give it to a staff member. If you're on Zoom and wish to speak, please raise your hand now. So, Courtney, has anyone submitted a request to comment on any of the uncontested items?
No.
So anyone on Zoom? Just confirming. All right, thank you. Any late revisions?
No.
No late revisions? Any legal issues to discuss?
No legal issues.
I will now entertain a motion for approval of the uncontested agenda items 12 through 14.
So moved.
Moved by Reeder. Do I have a second?
Second.
Second by Kadara. Courtney, please call the roll.
Board Member Kadara?
Yes.
Board Member Bradford?
Yes.
Board Member Yang?
Aye.
Board Member Baggett?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lee Reeder?
Aye.
And Chair Appis?
Aye. All right, now we're on to item number 9. Enforcement process presentation. The Office of Enforcement and of the State Water Resources Control Board. This is an informational item only. Vaughn West, the director of the State Water Resources Control Board Office of Enforcement, will provide an overview of the enforcement process to the board. Again, this is an informational item, and no action will be taken, although the board may ask questions and provide directions to staff. We'll now hear the staff presentation. Welcome, Yvonne.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair.
Members of the board, thank you very much for having me here this morning. Yvonne West, Director of the Office of Enforcement. I am joined here this morning with Perry Ellis from my office. He's in the audience. He is one of your OE attorney liaisons. You have two other liaisons from my office, Naomi Rubin and Heather Jidkoff. I do have a presentation. I'm hoping it's going to get pulled up. Okay, there we go. Awesome. Thank you. Just a little background on the Office of Enforcement before I get into my presentation. So the Office of Enforcement was created in recognition of the fact that enforcement is an essential to achieve the Water Board's missions of protecting water quality, water supply, and water availability for the benefit of present and future generations. The Office of Enforcement assists in achieving this mission by promoting fair, consistent, and transparent enforcement of water rights, water quality, and drinking water laws. And we try to accomplish this by ensuring that violations are properly investigated, documented, and enforced in accordance with applicable laws and Water Board's policies. In addition to our legal support to the Regional Board's enforcement staff, we also provide technical assistance with several of our technical units housed in the Office of Enforcement as well, including our Special Investigations Unit, our Fraud Prevention Unit, our UST Unit, We have a small cannabis enforcement unit as well. And we just more recently received a few resources to assist with Division of Drinking Water Enforcement. With that, if I can go to the next slide, I'm here today to really talk with you outside of the context of any specific enforcement action about the enforcement process generally. I'm hoping to create some dialogue and about some of the processes that the boards don't get to see in these chambers at these meetings, and just to provide a broader understanding of the time and energy that goes into your enforcement program. I'll be preparing a presentation that starts with the prioritization, and it works its way through to case resolution. And then towards the end, I have a few highlights from the recent enforcement policy water quality enforcement policy updates that took place in 2024. So with the next slide, please. As I'm sure you're aware, it's important to note that not every violation of our water codes will result in enforcement. As much as possible and appropriate, staff works to resolve compliance issues efficiently and cooperatively with a regulated entity through more informal tools, like phone calls. Sorry, I'm just looking at this as a little bit. My slide deck is a little bit off here, sorry. I'm sure you're aware, we have a lot of enforcement activity and a lot of potential violations at the regional board level. On a daily basis, your staff is working with a regulated community to ensure that they are complying with applicable water quality laws and permits. Your staff can identify potential enforcement cases through inspections, either from conducting inspections themselves or having referrals from other agencies, from complaints received from the public, by reviewing reports that are submitted by permittees as parts of their permitting requirements, or even by identifying missing reports that should have been submitted. These are just some of the ways that enforcement cases come to our attention. Another action, a little bit more proactive approach, is sometimes we will take on enforcement and compliance initiatives in specific programs, maybe new programs or programs with new requirements, where we'll proactively go out and try to assess compliance and bring enforcement on a batch basis. Next slide, please. This was the slide I jumped to unintentionally too quickly. As a preliminary matter, just as I was saying, it's important to note that not every violation results in enforcement. Of course, it's not always appropriate. And whenever possible, we try to resolve any failure to comply through an informal means, through phone calls and emails, notices of violation. Staff really do spend a lot of time with compliance assistance, and the majority of our violations do resolve in this manner. We, as the water boards, prefer compliance over enforcement, and these tools often achieve that objective efficiently. However, when they don't, the prosecution team retains discretion on how to approach cases and violations, including taking emergency actions or even bypassing these preliminary enforcement tools when appropriate. Next slide, please. Looking at case prioritization, as you know, there are more violations than resources available to address violations, and prioritization of potential enforcement cases is a very meaningful exercise. We recommend that the regional board enforcement staff meet periodically with their head of enforcement, be that their AEO or any other or their other enforcement lead, along with an OE attorney liaison to discuss cases and look at cases and their unique facts on an individual basis and determine where they fall within the board's priorities and the potential enforcement actions that could be brought. In circumstances and situations where formal enforcement is being contemplated, staff often next step will be to request the assignment of an OE attorney. And then that OE attorney can meet with staff and triage a case and determine weaknesses and strengths of the case, potential options, and provide recommendations of different enforcement tools that could be used to obtain compliance. Can we go ahead to the next slide, please? Just quickly, we have a variety of tools at our disposal, And at that point where a case gets referred to the Office of Enforcement, that is usually where we see, we talk start talking about separation of functions. This is procedurally one of the issues that's talked about the most in enforcement. Anytime an enforcement becomes highly likely, heavily anticipated, we usually at that point on a case-specific basis will separate functions. And just to kind of talk about that concept and the need for it and why we do it, we require staff who serve on the advisory team and staff who serve on the prosecution team to refrain from substantive communication about any potential future enforcement action on specific case-by-case basis. In other words, we do this to preserve the board's ability to serve as a decision maker on administrative enforcement actions, including preserving their ability to adopt an order after a contested hearing, such as an administrative civil liability order, or to adopt or reject a settlement. The process of separation of functions is really intended to ensure that the board and the EO remains a non-involved reviewer and available to preside over any settlements or hearings and can serve as that neutral adjudicator. Next slide, please. I'm going to briefly just talk about the various roles on the two teams. And again, if you have any questions or want any more depth, please just let me know. Generally speaking, on an enforcement issue, on your prosecution team, you'll have your assistant executive officer or your other enforcement lead, your compliance and enforcement supervisor, some technical staff that are assigned to that team, an OE attorney, possibly some technical staff from the Office of Enforcement serving as either technical support or expert witnesses. And then on the advisory team, generally we reserve the executive officer. The regional board technical staff are walled off to serve as your technical advisors. They can answer your questions, and your OCC attorney. Next slide. Just diving in a little more on the prosecution team and what that team does now that we've identified who they are. Whether or not, so as a general matter in enforcement, whether or not a case results in settlement, the prosecution team participates and engages in the prioritization and the decisions surrounding whether or not to bring a case to enforcement. They also, as the name implies, prosecution team, they advocate for a particular result in an enforcement action at a contested hearing or in a proposed settlement. They're often the party, they are the party who will negotiate the terms of a settlement, including supplemental environmental projects, which we'll talk about a little bit more, and they present evidence and argument at a hearing and answer board and advisory team questions. So that's the general high-level role of the prosecution team. Next slide. And the advisor team that we just outlined, their role is to assist the decision maker, be it the board or the executive officer, in conducting a hearing or formulating a decision. They can request the parties to submit additional materials or address specific hearings at an issue. They assist the board with deliberating in closed session, and they represent the board if the order is challenged after adoption. Also, the advisory team advises on compliance with policy and statutory requirements, such as minimum penalties and the supplemental environmental project policy. It's important when we talk about separation of functions to just kind of understand where communications can and can't occur. I know that as a board, you've been briefed on them and have guidance on them. But just as a reminder, the advisory team, if the board wishes to discuss a matter in closed session, for example, the advisory team is available to help with those discussions. They can have open communication between the advisory team and the board, whereas the prosecution team is excluded from those types of discussions. The prosecution team should only be addressing the board along with the other parties. Next slide. Just a real quick overview of the chair and the board's role in enforcement proceedings. Of course, you hear the party's evidence and argument. You weigh that evidence. You are the neutral decision maker. consider the public interest and other interested parties' comments, formulate and issue the final decision, and you have the ultimate authority to make all policy, procedural, legal, and factual decisions. So, next slide. We've talked generally about the roles and responsibilities and the different teams involved in enforcement when we get to a formal enforcement proceeding, but I just wanted to outline some of the other tools that leading up to that we can exercise and use as an enforcement team. We have at our disposal investigative orders, investigative subpoena authority. We can issue cease and desist orders, cleanup and abatement orders, administrative civil liability orders, and then I'll talk a little bit towards the end about the referrals to the Attorney General office or other outside prosecutors as enforcement team in investigating and conducting investigations. We sometimes find ourselves in a circumstance where we'll provide that information or refer that information out to another local entity or municipality or prosecutor like the local DA who may be bringing a related case or may just have other grounds on which they can pursue compliance on our behalf while pursuing their own violations. So, next slide. Real quickly, I'm going to talk about some of the different pathways to enforcement when we get to the a point where we are bringing formal enforcement. I talked about all the tools previously, and then these are kind of how we use those tools. We have three main pathways for administrative civil liability cases, and I'm going to talk a little bit about them. There's the compressed administrative civil liability, and then settlements, and then administrative civil liability complaints. The majority of our cases really do end in some sort of settlement before we end up going to a formal administrative civil liability complaint, but I just want to talk about those processes and provide you some familiarity with them. On the next slide, I want to talk about compressed ACLs, administrative civil liability complaints. So compressed ACLs are kind of a streamlined approach to administrative civil liability. They're similar to expedited payment letters, which is a tool that your region uses effectively in the MMP realm when mandatory minimum penalties are at play. And similar to those expedited payment letters, what a compressed ACL is a single document that provides the allegations, a penalty methodology under the enforcement policy, and an offer for settlement all at once. This is a little bit of a newer tool. Other regions have had success using this tool for construction stormwater enforcement. Compressed ACLs like this are typically used where we have a violation that is very straightforward and supported by photographic evidence or other documented evidence, such as in the inspection reports, where there's really not a lot of disagreement about the facts at issue. There are incentives for dischargers to accept the offer of settlement in a compressed administrative civil liability order. For example, so you could have an inspection, a construction stormwater inspection that has identified multiple violations, but the prosecution team could decide to pursue enforcement through a compressed administrative civil liability, and they would only allege the most egregious violations to expedite the process in the ACL and then provide an offer of settlement that complies with the penalty methodology in the enforcement policy. And this creates an incentive for the discharger to accept the settlement offer as opposed to both parties investing more time and resources to further develop a more complex complaint documenting every single violation. And really, like I said, would focus on the most egregious violations and get us to a place of compliance with some penalties quicker and, again, with less resources on both sides being invested in the process. Next slide. As I mentioned, we often end in settlement. A lot of our formal enforcement actions resolve before you see them in a contested hearing. We can enter settlement or engage in those discussions both before the issuance of administrative civil liability complaint or after the issuance. And there's again, strategic discussions and decisions that are made by the prosecution team on the timing. There are some advantages to engaging in settlement discussions before the issuance because you're not on a time clock. You're not on that 90-day hearing schedule yet. It gives the parties some more time to dig into the details and discuss the facts surrounding the violations, the allegations, and provide greater understanding for the prosecution team and the advisory team. I'm sorry, the prosecution team and the regulated entity. It just provides more time for that process. It also gives us more insight and opportunity to reach a consensus without being under that 90-day hearing clock. Next slide. Why settle? The settlements, I think, have a number of benefits to them. Creates a little more certainty of what the actual outcome is going to be to the case. It prevents future litigation if you reach a consensus. Fewer staff resources going into a hearing before the board. It allows us to obtain some important concessions or incorporate elements that you can't otherwise impose through an administrative civil liability order, such as supplemental environmental projects and enhanced compliance actions. And I'm going to talk about those briefly as well. I just want to really emphasize the fact that as an enforcement team, there are always opportunities for discussion and settlement, and we often engage the regulated entity, like I said, either before we issue the complaint or after the complaint to understand their side of the story and take into account any facts that we may not have uncovered during the investigation. It is an iterative process. Next slide. As a reminder, I'm not going to go into these code sections, but when we do enter settlement discussions, it's important that they are confidential, and there are evidence code provisions that preserve that confidentiality. That allows us to have those open conversations with the regulated entity to understand, again, the facts at issue and their side of the story. It allows having the settlement discussions be confidential, meaning we can't show up if the settlement falls apart and we don't reach resolution. We can't show up and say, well, they were willing to settle. So obviously they're guilty. And they can't show up and say they were willing to take less money. So obviously it's not worth what they're asking for now. Those are the kind of things that, you know, when we get into confidential settlement discussions, we need to be very open and candid in order to get someplace where we can reach a mutually beneficial compromise. With that, next slide. We can still talk to the board in generality about the settlement process. We can let you know that we had settlement discussions. Settlements do take time. Depending on the case, it's not uncommon for a settlement negotiation to take 3 to 6 months. I'm going to go ahead and say up to a year. We've had some very complex, high penalty value cases where it takes a year to work out the details of a supplemental environmental project that's detailed enough and certain enough to include in a settlement agreement. Supplemental environmental projects are great. They're often used to fund projects within communities that are impacted by the violation. A lot of regions really take advantage of the ability to use 100% of the penalty toward a project if it benefits an EJ, environmental justice, DAC, or vulnerable community, or otherwise helps forward access to safe, clean drinking water. But those projects take time to identify and to work out those details. They allow us, as I'd mentioned before, to learn new information or facts that we may not have uncovered during our investigation. And we take those facts into consideration. We want to know what the perspective of the regulated entity is and why they think they should or shouldn't be subject to liability, or what they did or didn't do in response to a violation or an allegation. And then we weigh it. We weigh it within the context of the enforcement policy. We will plug it into the penalty methodology. We'll weigh litigation risk, the uncertainty of bringing it before the board versus reaching a settlement. We'll look at equitable factors, evidentiary issues, and other weaknesses of our case. If we are able to reach a mutually agreed upon settlement, then it's really important that we're transparent about how we got there. And I'll talk about the process of that a little bit later, but generally speaking, when I say transparent, it means we still comply with the policy, we still adhere to the penalty methodology, and then, as I'll discuss later as well, we issue it for public comment for 30 days, and we detail if there was a movement in the penalty that we are proposing, we originally proposed versus what we're settling for, we'll document why. Why did we change? Was it litigation risk? Was it other things they brought to light? What were the facts we considered? And then again, we notice it for public comment for 30 days. There's a consideration after that by the executive officer or the board in light of all the public comments received. Next slide, I'm going to hit on some of the things I just said too. The board's role, if your executive officer can exercise authority to approve a settlement, or they can decline to exercise their authority and bring it to the board, and then the board would be in the position of either accepting or rejecting the settlement agreement as proposed by the parties, looking at whether there's sufficient information to make the decision. If you do not feel it is, you can ask the parties for more information. You can reject a settlement and set it for hearing. If there's disagreement with the settlement terms, you can direct the parties to resume negotiations, or you can reject it and set it for a contested hearing at a future meeting. What's really important is that settlements are kind of a yes-no for the decision maker, the neutral decision maker. And because there's that risk of a potential future adverse hearing or contested hearing, it is not appropriate at that point to get into the evidence and start weighing the evidence or prejudge the result of what a hearing might bring about. But that's the role of the regional board in the settlement once we bring it to you. Next slide. I've talked a couple times about supplemental environmental projects, and I don't think this board has seen one recently, but it is... I just want to take a minute to kind of answer some of the frequent questions we get about supplemental environmental projects. I'll define what it is, how they're selected, what briefly touch on what rules apply, and then how does the prosecution team learn about these projects? Next slide. So just real briefly, a supplemental environmental project is a very clearly defined project. It has to have environmental benefits. That the person who's being subject to the enforcement action voluntarily agrees to undertake in a settlement to offset a portion of their liability. The term environmentally beneficial means that the project must improve, protect, or reduce risk to the public health or the environment. We have a SEP policy that applies to these projects, and our SEP policy provides that the project should directly benefit groundwater, surface water, or drinking water quality or quantity, and the beneficial uses of the waters of the state. Next slide. Often there's a number of ways we can identify a project to be included in a settlement. The discharger can propose it. First party SEPs or SEPs that are projects that are undertaken by the discharger. You can have a situation where a discharger, you know, has a certain expertise in a certain area, or they have property that they can use for a project, and so they take it on themselves. Our website, the Office of Enforcement website, has links to the Cal EPA available SEP programs. There's a way that community organizations can put projects on that list for consideration for funding through enforcement. And then some regions have third-party administrators, agreements with third-party administrators like the Rose Foundation, who will have a list of projects that the prosecution team can consider that are pre-approved by the board, and the prosecution team can consider funding those projects through an enforcement action if the regulated entity is open to funding such a project. Next slide. We have a SEP policy, as I mentioned previously. It has some pretty detailed requirements on what the project must do and how the project has to be related to the violations being resolved. These are some of the requirements, like a nexus to the alleged violations. That nexus can be geographical in the same area for the benefit of the same community. It can have a nexus to the water body impacted or the type of violation. It could be like a construction stormwater violation, and you could have a sediment control project that you would adopt as part of your settlement. Next slide. There's restrictions on the amount of the penalty that can be suspended for the completion of a project. As I mentioned earlier, one of the exceptions to that is if you have a project that is located in or benefits a vulnerable community, such as a disadvantaged community or an EJ community, or a community with a financial hardship, then you can actually use up to 100% of your penalty amount if you can make those findings. And so that's an important exception that a lot of regions are taking advantage of. Next slide. There's a time limit on SEPs. These are not funding, these projects are not long-term projects. These are not enforcement, they're funded by individual enforcement actions. They're not good for funding sustainable long-term projects. The SEP policy requires that they be completed within 36 months. All of the SEP policy requirements that we're talking about, the limit on the amount, the limit on the timing, all of those is because these monies are viewed as their state funds. Even though we don't actually take them, we're imposing them, and that they are statutorily obligated to go to a certain fund, the Cleanup and Abatement Fund or the Waste Discharge Permit Fund. And when we, through a settlement, divert them to a project, there's still this need for accountability. It is the spending of state dollars. We have found historically that the shorter projects, it's easier to keep track of them, make sure that they get completed. You don't have turnover in the regulated entity as much. And that is, again, that accountability is the reason why these limits exist in the SEP policy. Next slide. And then the dischargers retain liability, generally speaking, until the project is over, unless it's part of a SEP program, a regional monitoring program, or some other SEP that allows for accumulation of funds and discharge of accountability early. This can be a disincentive for some parties, just want to get it over with. They don't want to wait till the project's completed. But it is really important that we retain some ability to regulate the party who owes us those state funds until the project is 100% completed. Next slide. Another type of project that we can fund through enforcement is an enhanced compliance action. The difference with this is that the enforcement policy allows a regulated entity to make capital improvements or operational improvements to their own facilities as long as they go beyond what is required by law. It cannot be just a project to come into mere compliance. It has to be something that's over and above. So there's a benefit for the spending of those state funds that are otherwise would have been collected as liability. The inclusion of enhanced compliance actions is, again, governed by the SEP policy and has to comply with SEP policy requirements. Next slide. And then the final one is compliance projects. And this is what I just said you can't do in an enhanced compliance project. Compliance projects are only available as statutorily defined for mandatory minimum penalties. And it's restricted to small communities with a financial hardship. And the project must bring the discharger back into compliance. And again, it's only in those circumstances that are authorized through statute. Next slide. So those were all the different projects that you can fund through settlement. And those, again, are instead of imposing liability. And then once we get to a settlement and we have a final agreement, this is the process that we would go through. And again, this is that transparency that I referenced. 30-day public notice comment period of all the details of the settlement. And then the prosecution team will provide a response to any comments that are submitted to the neutral adjudicator. So we present it then to the advisory team, and then it can be approved either by your executive officer through a delegation after a consultation with the board chair, or the settlement may be approved by the full board in a meeting in open session. Okay, next slide. Sorry, I know this is pretty detailed. I'm getting into a lot. If we don't settle, then that is when UCS issued this administrative civil liability complaint. And it's kind of like, in the attorney terms, we call it like a charging document. So assuming it doesn't settle, the prosecution team will issue a complaint. It identifies the dischargers, the alleged violations, the supporting evidence, and it proposes a liability amount using the penalty methodology that is in our enforcement policy. Next slide. This is when we come before you in a hearing, the ACL complaint hearings. These are contested evidentiary hearings. Most ACL complaints are heard during regular board meetings, but some are heard over multiple days. We have more recently in a number of regions had multi-day hearings for significant penalties. We've had some penalties upwards of $6 million at a number of our boards recently, and those often require multiple day hearings. We've had some boards choose to do site visits on some of the bigger cases prior to doing the hearings. It can get pretty entailed and can be involve a lot of your time. The board is, the neutral decision maker, but there is no opportunity to fund any of those projects that we just discussed, a supplemental environmental project or an enhanced compliance action. Those, again, are only funded through an agreement and a settlement. After a hearing, sorry, we went to the next slide. That's okay, you can go there. After the hearing, the board, of course, would issue the decision. Another route we can take if we're unable to reach a settlement is referrals to the Attorney General's office. And this is how we exercise our judicial authority to get civil penalties imposed. Historically, we don't do it very frequently. We have been for more complex cases more recently. It's a good option when we have multiple state agencies involved, then we want to get like a uniform settlement or a uniform resolution. Let's say CDFW has violations and we have violations. The AG's office can sometimes represent both of us as long as our interests are aligned and reach a resolution for all the state agencies engaged. It would also be a good tool if we had violations that crossed multiple regional boards. We had a responsible party operating and violating in multiple regions. We could seek recourse through the Attorney General's office. It has been used in the past where there's resource constraints and we don't have the staff capacity to bring a case. Some of these larger cases that we've brought more recently before regions, one started out administratively and then we decided we needed to take it to the Attorney General's office. There are some advantages. In that case, we decided to go to the Attorney General's office because the separation of functions had gotten very complicated. We had multiple cases against the party who was filing Public Record Act complaints against us, and we had, as a team, it was difficult to coordinate across those separation of functions on the response to those actions. It also allowed us to talk directly with the board and strategize directly with the board on the enforcement. The board was interested in having more say. At the time, we had an interim EO in the region as opposed to a appointed EO. And so we dropped the separation of functions and referred it to the Attorney General's office and then opened discussions directly with the board on the enforcement strategy. So there are times when this makes sense, but it can also be expensive. You lose some element of control over your case and the timing of your case. I hate to generalize, but they do tend to drag on a little longer. Next slide. All right, I'm going to pause here. I can stop here, too, if we're good. I have just a few highlights in the enforcement changes to the enforcement policy that I can highlight for you. But I wanted an opportunity, while all of that information I just dumped on you is a little bit fresh, to ask any questions you might have about the enforcement process and anything that I presented to you on that.
Go ahead, Denise.
I don't have any questions, Yvonne, but I would say that was very thorough. As a board member, I've sat here and over the years and, you know, we've made decisions on ACLs, but not having the full understanding of all that goes behind. So I really appreciate that exercise you walked us through. Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Sean.
Yeah, I too want to say thank you for the very thorough presentation so far. The only question I have is, how many languages do we have now currently in terms of communications with the other parties?
So we have the ability, we work with OPIDA to translate documents and get in-person translators when we have hearings. I don't know if there's limits on which languages we can provide. We've provided a number of languages depending on the program area or the responsible party. Most frequently, it's Spanish or Hmong. We have been translating a lot of our FAQs in various programs. And again, with some coordination, we're able to, and we've had to bring in translators into the hearings for purposes of those hearings, we will accommodate what the needs are.
And I do want to thank you for the presentation. For the board members' purposes, there has been an increased awareness and instinct to try and use SEPs. I think a lot of it is influenced by the fact that the Central Coast Regional Board not too long ago worked with the State Water Board to create a drinking water testing program. I think it's Morro Bay Foundation is the one that administers it, to test for more than just nitrate, but other water quality contaminants. So there's been some interest in working through those type of solutions. I will likely refer you to this presentation if those issues come up, so that you'll have, you know, Yvonne's presentation to us available to view anytime through YouTube prior to consideration of one of those items, or when we're talking about a settlement that might involve something of that nature. I don't know if we have to go through, we probably don't have to go through the enforcement policy updates, but totally consistent with what Board Member Yang asked. The big ones for our region, the updates, there's a lot of nuts and bolts and mechanical updates, but the big one that I want to just let you know is there's an increased emphasis on EJ outreach in connection with both the enforcement action and potential settlements. So, for example, if the board is aware of, or the board actually does a little bit of research and finds out that a disadvantaged community is potentially affected or interested in the settlement, we will engage that community in a language that's spoken within that community to try and let them comment. You know, every once in a while they'll say, this is great, thanks for doing this enforcement work. And other times the community might raise their hand and say, no, you don't even know what's going on around here. We have other types of complaints that we'd like to articulate to you. Sometimes those are complaints that can be addressed by the action. Other times those aren't complaints that are addressed by our agency, and we can refer them elsewhere. But I think that's the big one for our region.
Yeah, that is really a big one, and we outline in the policy that we do have resources in OE. We have an environmental justice liaison, and we work with OPEDA closely. We can definitely facilitate that outreach in those meetings, which is recommended in the policy.
Appreciate that explanation. Thank you.
Hi, Yvonne.
Hi.
Thank you for sharing with us how the sausage is being made. I know a lot went into your presentation. I just have a quick question. What percentage would you say of the cases end up in settlements?
I would say we settle 90% of our cases.
That's a lot of work. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank possibly you even more.
What?
You're possibly even more in the Central Valley. You know, it's been quite a while since we've brought a contested administrative civil liability to this board. It's a testament, I think, certainly to the ability and expertise in our prosecution teams and in the Office of Enforcement, but also in the fact that prior iterations of this board, and Denise, I know you've sat on it, the discharger community knows that we carry a big stick and are not afraid to use it. And I think that really encourages the instinct to settle, and it discourages folks from saying, no, I think the board is going to be a pushover, and I'll take my chances with the board, see if they can whittle this $100,000 settlement down to $50. You know, that is not going to happen, generally speaking, at this board.
And that's a good point, Patrick. Obviously, there's a high deterrence factor. Obviously that comes with the aggressiveness of the prosecutorial, aspects of what we do. So, Yvonne, I wanted to say thank you. It's a good overview and a good refresher for many of us. It's a complicated, I will say, a procedural construct. The separation of function aspect was still one that it wrapping my head around it, even as an attorney, it is a unique creation, and how it works. I'm always learning new things, and do appreciate that great comprehensive overview. So, what's that? Mark, I'm sorry, did you?
I was just going to ask, this is a very complex process, obviously, and you probably have a lot in the pipeline. Are we ever resource constrained for how to deal with these cases as they come before you?
Yeah, the enforcement program, and I think you're going to hear from Jill soon, you'll get some real numbers on how constrained the program is. Really, you know, our office and the regional boards are all constrained on staff time. A lot of your staff isn't dedicated directly to, strictly to enforcement. They split their time with permitting and compliance assistance, regulatory functions. So that prioritization and triaging of cases is very important, making sure we're having those deliberate conversations, frequently meeting with your OE liaison to look at specific cases and ask. We ask the team to consider, is this the highest priority? Is this aligned with the regional board's priorities for the year or the five-year plan? Before we invest the resources and go down that road, we don't ever want to issue a complaint and have to back off. Once we go down that road, we're in for it. As long as it takes to get to that resolution. So, I mean, that's really where it's important to have that conversation with the board and understand where to put your limited resources. We can't enforce violations, all violations across all program areas. Often one of the way we deal with it is we'll pick a specific area that we think is lagging in compliance and do an enforcement initiative that involves batch enforcement actions against a significant number of the regulated population in order to bring up the compliance rate generally in the program. And so those deliberate and conscious efforts to decide what to pursue and not to pursue are really what make the program successful.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Seeing there are more comments on the board.
Thank you all for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I do want to open this for public comment to see if there are any commenters on this item. Again, a reminder, this is purely informational, no action, but do we have anybody, Courtney, signed up to speak?
No, we do not.
Okay. All right. With that, we will take a short break. How about 8 minutes? Come back at 10 till. I want to keep things moving. Okay, 10 minutes. 10 minutes. We'll come back at 10:53. We'll take a short bio break. Okay, I'd like to call the meeting back into session. So everybody assume your positions. Jill, I'd like you to not be nervous, but just know that all eyes are on you, and it is being broadcast on live stream on YouTube. So with that, I'd like to call up the next item. We have a compliance and enforcement program update from our Fresno office. Again, this is informational item only. So I will hand it over to Jill at this point to take over the presentation of this item. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. I have a presentation. Good morning, Chair Advis and members of the board. Today, I will be providing an update to the Fresno Compliance and Enforcement Program. I am Jill Galletter, a supervising engineering geologist in the Fresno office and also the Fresno Enforcement Program supervisor. Next slide. I'd like to start by showing you the programs that are in the Fresno office. The Fresno office consists of about 80 people who work with a variety of water board programs throughout our region, as shown here on this slide. Many staff in our office work on more than one program within their respective units. Within each program, we regulate numerous types of different facilities and dischargers. Next slide. This table highlights examples of the types of facilities we permit under Fresno's different programs. For example, we regulate over 700 confined animal facilities, such as poultry and dairies. The entire Region 5 oil field program is located only in the Fresno office, and we regulate nearly 1,300 wastewater disposal ponds throughout the oil fields within our large region. Under our waste discharge to land program, we regulate over 650 facilities. Nearly half of them are domestic wastewater treatment facilities, with a large number being located in a disadvantaged community. Under our stormwater program, we permit about 1,800 sites, which include industrial, construction, and municipal-type permits. And lastly, for our irrigated lands program, we regulate a variety of farmlands, such as almonds, pistachios, grapes, and tomatoes. The number of almond farms alone that are registered with the Fresno office is over 8,000 farms. Once again, this is just a snapshot of the facilities we regulate in the Fresno office. Next slide. I would like to show you the kind of enforcement that comes out of our programs. This chart highlights the number and type of enforcement actions that our office produced during the fiscal year 2024-2025. As you can see, the majority of our work consisted of NOVs, or notices of violations, and noncompliance letters. Typically, violations are discovered through inspections and sometimes from spills, complaints, or issues related to monitoring reports. We also issued quite a few enforcement letters, which are informal notices of minor violations tailored to an individual facility. Dischargers typically are responsive to these letters and are able to get back into compliance. We also issued 3 Water Code Section 13267 orders, which require dischargers to submit technical reports. Moving to the bottom of this list, I want to note that we successfully completed a cease and desist order, which I will talk more about later in this presentation. I highlight this enforcement tool because it is a very time-consuming process on the scale of months or years and resources consuming. Its completion is a great success for our office. Next slide. When it comes to enforcement, we have a consistent approach to each case, but the resources we use will depend on the program. Here is a list of 12 programs that handle their own compliance and enforcement within their units, along with implementing the day-to-day requirements of their programs. For these 12 programs, typically the enforcement process starts with technical staff and then will move up to management and finally to the lead prosecutor. They will all work together with help from attorneys with the State Water Board's Office of Enforcement to carry out the enforcement process. Our compliance and enforcement unit, which is not shown on this list and I will talk about in the next slide, supports these programs on an as-needed basis, but typically they work independently of our compliance and enforcement unit. Next slide. We handle enforcement a little differently for these two programs shown on the left side of the slide. Our MPDES wastewater and the waste discharge to lands program focus primarily on preparing permits within their units. Currently, over 750 facilities are permitted by these two programs out of the Fresno office. Because of the large number of facilities and the complexity of sites regulated, program staff are devoted primarily to permitting activities. Once a permit has been issued, compliance and enforcement unit staff have primary responsibility for inspections and enforcement activities. Our compliance and enforcement unit, shown at the top right, manages compliance and enforcement for both the MPDES wastewater program and the waste discharge to land program. This structure allows each unit to focus its efforts on different aspects of the programs while working together as needed. It is not uncommon for our permitting program staff and our compliance and enforcement staff to collaborate, for example, during inspections. Next slide. Here is an overview of the type of work our compliance and enforcement unit conducts on a regular basis. As just mentioned, Staff in this unit are responsible for evaluating compliance and taking enforcement when needed of over 750 facilities permitted under the MPDES wastewater and waste discharge to land programs. Staff evaluate compliance primarily through conducting inspections and reviewing monitoring data submitted by dischargers. When noncompliance is identified, technical staff work with the unit's senior engineer and upper management as necessary to prepare enforcement actions. Additionally, the Compliance and Enforcement Unit responds to 75 to 100 public complaints annually, such as odor complaints, reports of nuisance discharges, cases of suspected unauthorized discharges, and reports of wastewater spills. They investigate when needed and take action where appropriate. Next slide. To give you an idea of our resources, here is a chart showing staffing within our Compliance and Enforcement Unit. As shown here, three staff are responsible for the 752 facilities regulated by our MPDES wastewater and waste discharge to land programs. That results in more than 250 sites per staff person. As the Fresno Enforcement Supervisor, I work with the Fresno Enforcement Senior and Unit staff to prioritize sites in alignment with the Regional Board's priorities and our enforcement policy. Next slide. The map shown here has Region 5 in the blue color, which expands from the Oregon border south to Los Angeles County. Although program-specific, most of the facilities we regulate are within the county shown by the red outline. As you can see, the Fresno office covers nearly half of the geographic area of our region. This results in some unique challenges not seen in more densely populated regions, including limited or non-existent infrastructure, significant time travel between sites, and remote and/or hazardous terrain. Next slide. Fresno Compliance and Enforcement staff each have workloads targets for planned inspections throughout the fiscal year. However, sometimes unplanned inspections are needed following a public complaint or accidental spill. Oftentimes, it is necessary for staff to respond immediately after a complaint, allowing them to inspect, document impacts, and preserve evidence. Unplanned inspections can lead to numerous follow-up site visits and even enforcement actions, requiring staff to rebalance priorities in an already heavy workload. The Southern Central Valley also faces unique challenges when it comes to groundwater concerns and how it relates to prioritizing enforcement. The groundwater is relatively deep, making it challenging to determine the threat to groundwater quality at various facilities in our region. In many of these areas, we get little recharge, and access to groundwater continues to deepen with time as we use it for irrigation and drinking water, further complicating the evaluation of water quality in our area. Another very common challenge we face is related to the legacy industries here in the Southern Central Valley. As I just mentioned, irrigation. Agriculture is a great example of legacy industry with its history of pesticide and fertilizer application, making it difficult to determine potential impacts to water quality from current operations versus historical practices. We will briefly discuss an example of this challenge later in the presentation. Our enforcement team faces similar challenges in other programs, such as near dairies, industrial sites, and in the oil fields. Next slide. Now I would like to highlight some of the enforcement work that came out of the Fresno office recently. Set in Pistachio is a nut processing facility in Terrabella that is regulated under our waste discharges to land program. The facility is highlighted in yellow, and their former wastewater storage pond is shown in blue to the west of the facility. The town of Terrabella has been designated by the state of California as a disadvantaged community, having a disproportionate burden in terms of pollution and socioeconomics. Its population is approximately 2,900 residents, and two schools, an elementary and a middle school, are located just east of the Seton Pistachio facility. Between 2018 and 2021, the Water Board staff and the local air district received over 300 complaints from Tarabella residents of objectionable odors and alleged the pistachio processing facility as the source. Our compliance and enforcement unit team investigated the complaints and found Seton Pistachio to be in violation of its permit under the odor and nuisance provisions. The violations at the facility resulted in the Water Board issuing Seton Pistachio a cease and desist order and subsequently an administrative civil liability, or ACL, order. Next slide. The terms of the ACL order required Seton Pistachio to pay 60% of the total penalty amount, and 40% of the penalty amount was used toward completion of a supplemental environmental project, or SEP. The SEP was proposed by Seton Pistachio and involved purchasing and paying for the installation of air scrubbers for all HVAC systems at the nearby elementary and middle schools. Seton Pistachio's proposal met the condition of a SEP, including the nexus requirement of having a relationship between the location of the facility and the location of the SEP. Next slide. Seton Pistachio successfully installed the air scrubbers into the two nearby schools, which are located within the red area on the map. These schools serve approximately 750 students total. The SEP was completed on time and approximately 5 months after the ACL order was issued. Additionally, Seton Pistachio has discontinued use of the pond for wastewater storage. This project is a good example of how SEPs can be used as part of the enforcement process and how they can benefit communities that have been impacted by our regulated dischargers. Next slide. Moving away from SEPs, I also want to highlight another successful enforcement case that came out of the Fresno office. That case was a cease and desist order for E&J Gallo Winery's Fresno Winery. E&J Gallo's Fresno Winery is a permitted facility located on the east side of Fresno, as you can see on this map. Our compliance and enforcement staff identified violations of the permit relating to E&J Gallo exceeding their agronomic rates and the deterioration of the winery byproduct storage pad. This resulted in Water Board staff beginning the progressive enforcement process against E&J Gallo, starting with a notice of violation and ending with an uncontested stipulated cease and desist order, or CDO. A stipulated CDO is a CDO where the designated parties, in this case the board's prosecution team and E&J Gallo, come to an agreement regarding the provisions and requirements set forth in the CDO, subject, of course, to the board's approval. A stipulation agreement that satisfied both parties was executed, and the stipulated CDO was adopted by the board in June 2025. Next slide. In summary, the stipulated CDO requires that E&J Gallo stop discharging in a manner that violates their permit. It also requires them to construct an engineered pad for the handling and temporary storage of winery byproducts that is protective of beneficial use waters and submit technical reports. E&J Gallo plans to cease wastewater discharge to land application areas within 5 years and instead discharge to the Fresno Clovis Wastewater Treatment Facility. Failure to comply with the CDO could result in curtailment of all discharges and further enforcement action. Next slide. During the process, Water Board staff experienced challenges that contributed to the time required to develop the stipulated CDO. Decades of discharge at the facility, along with surrounding farmland from agricultural operations, challenged water board staff when analyzing the data for the case. We had to distinguish between impacts from current and legacy activities while trying to develop an order that identified all pertinent issues that needed to be corrected. Due to the limited number of staff in the compliance and enforcement unit, as mentioned earlier, only one staff member was originally assigned to the case and was responsible for analyzing all these data. Ultimately, we identified staff from other programs with the essential technical expertise needed and assigned them to the team to assist in analysis and in developing the technical arguments necessary to support the CDO. Additionally, during the development of the CDO, Fresno's supervising enforcement program engineer had retired, adding to the staffing challenges. Despite these challenges, however, staff were successful in developing a CDO that was supported by both parties involved, was publicly supported based on public comments received, and unanimously adopted by the board. Next slide. This concludes my presentation. Thank you for your time. And now I'm available to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you, Jill. Well done. I'd like to open up to see if we have any public comment first before we go to board discussion here. Do we have any public commenters on this item? Again, it's merely informational, but do we have any commenters?
None.
Okay. At this point, I want to open it up for board discussion. Do we have any board questions or comments on Jill's overview of enforcement actions in Fresno?
Jill, thank you for the report. I'm familiar with both of these projects, and great job for the staff that pursued the work that you did to bring the projects into compliance. So I appreciate the update you provided to us.
Thank you.
John.
Yeah, I too want to say thank you for the presentation. It was very thorough. I enjoyed it. I just wanted to mention about the groundwater. I know that in the Fresno County area / Madera, the groundwater level from different location to the next, it could be substantially different. I myself have lived in Madera County and Fresno and Sanger. So I'm just very appreciative of the agency that we work with that able to provide drinking water and providing alternative solutions when family that use well water and their well is not working, and providing that alternative solution, which providing water to them. It was very helpful, and they are very thankful. So I just want to take this opportunity to say great job in that sense, and look forward to for us collaborating with other agencies to provide even a more effective solution going in the future. However, I do have one question. As far as I know, currently we don't have limits on how much folks use groundwater. And just curious if that is something that will change in the future.
So I think the and we'll try and get you some information on SGMA, which is the comprehensive program to regulate groundwater and groundwater, at least the groundwater supply throughout much of the state. That process is largely within the Department of Water Resources. But the groundwater sustainability plans developed by groundwater sustainability agencies are reviewed by the State Water Board, who has the authority to put basins into probation when they are not meeting those objectives. Again, this is more of an issue for State Water Board and the Department of Water Resources. They have received quite a lot of money and are still working on implementing that bill. So groundwater supply is not within the purview of this agency.
Thank you.
So, Jill, I had a question on the SEP. During the course of those discussions and negotiations on those violations. At what point did the concept of an SEP get introduced in those negotiations? Yeah, or maybe you can walk me through as an example and on the heels of our last item.
Yeah.
Just to understand procedurally, you know, how that...
You know, it varies project to project. It just
is it that level of subjectivity based on a case-by-case? I don't say subjectivity,
incredible.
Ad hoc.
I mean, there are... And I've been a party to enforcement discussions that have involved SCPs, both in the advisory capacity and in the prosecutorial capacity. Every case is different. So, for example, there are cases where the discharger will initially protest any liability whatsoever. So the majority of the initial discussions are, you know, explaining and trying to settle on relatively, you know, agreed upon settlement amount. You know, sometimes it starts discharger saying zero, we say a lot, and it comes out to some number in between. And when it comes to that number in between, oftentimes the dischargers tend to say, well, what can I do to benefit my local community and deal with this water quality issue? In which case, we'll discuss a SEP and provide them a copy of the SEP policy and say, let's have a conversation about this. Other times, their dischargers tend to be, you know, ones that have reoccurring, either they're employing attorneys or consultants that have regular experience before the regional board, and they'll say, you know, we still have to hammer out a final liability number, but we'd like a SEP included, you know. And so they'll start that conversation right off the bat. So it really varies, you know, discharger by discharger, case by case. Sometimes it's at the very end. It actually has happened where we are just about to finalize that settlement, and they say, well, wait a second, you know, maybe I do want a SEP after all. And a lot of those discussions, of course, happen internally. Sometimes SEPs are proposed by dischargers that have a board to answer to, and so they'll present, you know, just like we do in closed session, here's a settlement to the regional board, and, you know, a board member or two will say, well, can we do something to keep that money local? And at which point they'll come back to us and say, you know, our board approved the amount, but we want to see what we can do for a SEP to address that. At other times, we get all the way through the process. You know, we are about to resolve that order. I'm about to sign it. And they say, wait a second, are you telling me a SEP costs a little bit more to implement? And it does. So we have to cover our oversight time for that. And then they say, yeah, I'd rather just cut a check and send it to the State Water Board. So wide, wide, wide variety of times in which it's introduced into the discussion.
Okay, that's helpful. All right, any other questions on this item? All right, thank you.
I just say thank you, Jill. And I wasn't aware how much of the Region 5 territory was covered by Fresno, and the numbers you threw out, pretty impressive, a number of facilities that you regulate. So thanks for the good work, and keep that staff motivated somehow. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Jill.
Thank you.
All right, now moving on to item 11, Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program Update. At this point, I'd ask Eric Warren to come up and provide an update to the board on the current progress towards developing crop-specific acceptable ranges of nitrogen applied relative to nitrogen removed for the Central Valley region. So obviously looking forward to this presentation, and I expect we have quite a few folks, perhaps. Maybe not quite a few folks, but we do have some public commenters, I believe. So with that, Eric, please take the mic.
Thanks. This is Eric. Just a small typo on the agenda. We'll actually have one of our Fresno staff, E.J. Wardley-Klein, to give the presentation.
Good morning, Chair Avdus and members of the board. My name is E.J. Wardley-Klein. I'm an engineering geologist for the Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program. I work out of the Fresno office. Today, I'm going to be presenting an informational item on the crop-specific multi-year acceptable ranges of applied nitrogen relative to nitrogen removed. Next slide, please. This presentation will first provide a brief refresher on nitrogen reporting, nitrogen applied and removed, nitrogen applied over removed calculations, and the East San Joaquin Petition Order's acceptable ranges mandate. Before moving on to provide an overview of the acceptable ranges work plan and development strategy, proposed acceptable ranges, the public comments received, preliminary staff comments, and the current progress of the project. Next slide, please. For those of you familiar with the Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program, you may recall that for each crop year, regulated commercial growers are required to submit an irrigation and nitrogen management plan summary report, herein referred to as an INMP. These reports have been submitted by a subset of growers in highly vulnerable areas since 2015. Beginning in 2019, this requirement was expanded to collect reporting from all regulated growers. The INMP quantifies the mass of nitrogen applied to the crop in the form of nutrients, fertilizers, and pre-existing nitrogen in irrigation water, and also provides the overall crop yield for that year. From this yield metric, the mass of the nitrogen removed by the crop can then be calculated by means of a crop-specific nitrogen concentration coefficient, which were originally developed and have been periodically updated by Dr. Daniel Geisler of UC Davis. The most recent update of these Geisler coefficients was in March of this year. Next slide, please. Nitrogen applied, A, divided by nitrogen removed, R, provides a unitless number. This is referred to here as the A over R. This ratio indicates the general efficiency of the crop regarding its nitrogen uptake. So, in general, an A over R equal to 1 would be 100% efficient. An A over R of less than 1 would be beyond 100% efficient. This is typical of crops which can fix atmospheric nitrogen, but in the majority of crops, this indicates a potential reporting error. And finally, an A over R greater than 1 represents increasing inefficiency as the number increases. Within our program, we're aiming for growers to achieve the lowest feasible A over R for each crop and regional setting. Next slide, please. As the INMP reporting program has grown more robust, the data set of A and R metrics has become more reliable. And appropriately, in the East San Joaquin Petition Order, State Board directed the Central Valley Water Boards to oversee the development of the A over R acceptable ranges. This was based, in part, on the recommendations of the first statewide agricultural expert panel in 2014. Next slide, please. In January 2024, a work plan outlining the development of A over R acceptable ranges was submitted on behalf of 13 growers' coalitions in the Central Valley. As requested, a multi-year approach was proposed in which a three-year average of the most recent and best available INMP data was used. By necessity, however, both the lower and upper bounds of these ranges required differing methods for development. Next slide. For each crop that was analyzed, the lower bound of the range represents the minimum A over R values that are expected to be routinely achievable under optimal growing and market conditions. This was based on scientific research, literature, and market factors. The upper bound of the range reflects A over R values that should be routinely achievable in most cases under a variety of real-world conditions. This was based on the 75th percentile of grower-reported INMP data from 2020 through 2022. These data were screened to remove potentially erroneous entries of applied nitrogen yield and those which were agronomically unsustainable, such as an A over R of less than 1. Next slide, please. Here's a hypothetical example of how this would work in practice. In this growing season, our cotton grower has applied 13,000 pounds of nitrogen to his field. His overall yield in both lint and seed combined was 175 tons. By multiplying this yield by the corresponding Geissler coefficient, we get the nitrogen removed in pounds. From there, it's a simple matter of dividing the nitrogen applied by that which was removed. In this case, the resultant A over R is 1.7, falling within the proposed acceptable range. Next slide, please. In October 2024, the crop-specific multi-year acceptable ranges of applied nitrogen relative to nitrogen removed was submitted on behalf of 13 growers' coalitions in the Central Valley, providing a nominal acceptable range of A over R for 193 different crops. This accounts for over 99% of the farmed acreage covered under the ILRP. Notably, some crops were excluded from this analysis. Alfalfa, which is the nitrogen fixer, rice, which is predominantly regulated under a separate commodity-specific general order, pasture land, which presents reporting difficulties, and some minor acreage crops for which a Geissler coefficient has yet to be derived. Next slide, please. The document was released for public comment period in October of 2024. These comments are public record, and their full text and context can be made available. But here I will summarize some of the key points made. First, a critique of the interpretation of the term acceptable within the greater context of the order, stating that, quote, a discharge that causes or contributes to exceedances of water quality objectives cannot be considered as such. Next, a request for greater transparency regarding the weighting of factors in the analysis, specifically the market factors cited by the authors. And finally, a concern that the upper bounds, quote, have unacceptably high acceptable ranges, especially for young trees. Next slide, please. A staff review is currently underway, and here are some of the key points which staff felt necessary to comment on. First, the currently proposed acceptable ranges are not intended to serve as enforceable numeric limits for nitrate loading. Therefore, the term acceptable should not be interpreted as an endorsement of nitrate overapplication. Next, to help ensure the lower range values are agronomically appropriate, staff intend to consult with the California Department of Food and Agriculture, CDFA, whose expertise will support a more robust evaluation of the proposed thresholds. And finally, a second statewide agricultural expert panel has been convened to evaluate the role of this and other metrics within the ILR program. Next slide. As I said, the analysis of these ranges is ongoing, and here is the current state of affairs. The A over R acceptable ranges are still under review, and during this process, staff will continue to coordinate with stakeholders, state board staff, and other regional boards to ensure development of appropriate ranges. Additionally, the second statewide agricultural expert panel has been convened and will be holding meetings through the end of this year. In the near future, a final report from the expert panel is expected in early 2026. And in the meantime, collaboration with the CDFA will continue. Once approved, these acceptable ranges will provide valuable feedback to growers regarding their crop efficiency and are also anticipated to serve as interim milestones in CV Salt's Priority 1 Management Zone implementation plans. Next slide. Here are my references. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, EJ. With that, Courtney, do we have any speakers on this item? Again, this is informational, and if you haven't put in a request to speak, now is the time to do so. Do we have?
We do.
Okay.
Ms.
Who's first?
Kaya Rivers.
Can you repeat who was that?
Kaya Rivers.
Oh, Kaya. Yes. Is Kaya on?
Hi. Good morning.
Hi, Kaya. Go ahead.
Good morning, everyone. Again, many communities are waiting. Oh, sorry. My name is Kaya Rivers. I'm a senior policy advocate at Community Water Center. And many communities are awaiting for the human right to water to be realized for access to safe drinking water. And the development of the acceptable A over R ranges is an important step towards realizing the human right to water for communities, as these ranges are intended to guide growers to reduce their nitrogen discharges and no longer cause exceedances of water quality objectives for nitrate. However, the proposed acceptable ranges are neither ambitious nor make progress towards achieving the objectives of the Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program. For example, the proposed lower bound of the acceptable ranges for some perennial crops spans from 1.43 to 2.4. And that means that dischargers who grow crops like corn can discharge up to 140% more nitrogen than what the crop can use and still be considered within an acceptable range of nitrogen discharge. Additionally, the upper bound of the acceptable ranges is set at a 75th percentile of all dischargers, and the agricultural coalitions established the top 75% of dischargers as outliers under the Irrigated Lands Program. This means that dischargers will be considered within an acceptable range as long as the discharger isn't identified as an outlier. Furthermore, the acceptable ranges, as mentioned in the presentation, are used again as the compliance milestone for the CV Salts program. And under the CV Salts Management Zone implementation plans, dischargers propose that it will take 20 years for growers to meet the proposed acceptable ranges. This is unacceptable. The proposed acceptable ranges don't encourage growers to make significant nitrogen discharges, and almost 75% of growers are already meeting the upper end of the acceptable range. We asked the regional board to further analyze these proposed acceptable ranges in order to ensure that they can be used as a tool to guide growers to make nitrogen reductions. And if the regional board does not have the capacity to analyze these proposed ranges, we ask the proposed ranges be reviewed by the State Water Board technical team or by an independent party. Thank you for the time today and for the opportunity to make public comment.
Thank you, Kaya. Who do we have next? I'd like to take all the public comments first before we have staff responses. So,
up next is Jennifer Clary.
Thank you very much. My name is Jennifer Clary. I'm the California Director of Clean Water Action and Clean Water Fund, and I've been working on this program since 2008. The idea of the acceptable ranges, as I read the 2018 order, is that they're supposed to promote reductions in nitrogen application. And in fact, the acceptable ranges that are published here reflect the current status of nitrogen application. And I'm really concerned that you're considering using this document as an interim milestone for CV Salts, because that infers that what is the current status quo would be an acceptable status quo to use for interim milestones. So I really would urge you to ask for a stronger number that's going to reflect a reduction in nitrate, because as long as we don't make strides in reducing nitrate application, we're going to continue to have increases in nitrate contamination in the valley's drinking water. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jennifer. Okay, do we have any more speakers?
No.
Oh, all right. We have one more?
Yes, we have a phone line ending in 815.
All right. A caller with a phone number ending in 815, are you on the line.
Yeah, this is David Corey with the Westside Tamaki River Watershed Coalition. sorry for not being there in person. I've been a little bit sick for the last couple of weeks, and I'll apologize up front if I'm a little bit more muddled than normal in my presentation because I'm not feeling that great. But just wanted to let you know the Irrigated Lands Coalitions have put a lot of time in this entire program, not just the acceptable ranges, but also our formulas, values, and targets. And to just point out that the acceptable ranges fit in with the formulas, values, and targets together into a comprehensive program to bring growers where necessary, you know, reducing their nitrogen application rates. So these acceptable ranges are really related to a nitrogen use efficiency number. And, you know, we'd be looking at these to target our outreach. But acceptable ranges are not the only metric we'll be using. We'll also be using the values and the targets as it relates to discharges as well. So it fits together into a broader program. That's pretty much what I have to say. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them as well. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Okay. At this point, I'd like to hand over to Adam. Would you care to... I'm sorry. We have one more. I'm sorry.
We do have one more comment. Nathaniel Kane.
Nathaniel Kane. Okay, please go ahead, Nathaniel. Nathaniel, are you on? Do we have Nathaniel on Zoom?
Nathaniel, you can accept to join as a panelist to speak.
Okay, well, maybe we'll have Nathaniel on. I don't know if he's having technical difficulties, but at this point, I'd like staff, and maybe Adam, I'll let you sort of traffic cop how you'd like to respond to some of the comments raised, and then I'm going to open it up for board discussion.
Yeah, no, and I just I want to thank everyone for commenting today on this item. We brought this item before the board today, frankly, because we wanted to hear comments from folks. We wanted you to have an opportunity to hear these comments as we review these acceptable ranges. We have the report. We have the technical information for this report. But just as some of the commenters mentioned, and I believe EJ mentioned in his presentation, we are working with CDFA to see, you know, what their review of these acceptable ranges might be. Given their expertise in agronomics and those types of technical information, so you know this is a first step. I think we're now trying to gather information on how we might implement these in the irrigated lands program, and as you heard, it's also these ranges would be implemented in the CV salts program also. So I think that's the first thing is kind of stepping back a little bit here. We have to figure out, you know, how these ranges would be used. I do disagree that the ranges would be a step backwards. I do think that right now what we have, all we have in our orders right now is a statistically based process that doesn't work terribly well for identifying outliers. I mean, it's the best we have, but this would set very clear, very obvious expectations for people and targets to meet. And so... In that sense, moving forward with these would, in my mind, be a step in the right direction. And I think the question that we all are trying to figure out now is how would we institute these ranges? You know, do we institute them as a goal for hitting the lower portion of those ranges and create a process for follow-up around that? Or do we use the larger ranges in and of themselves? And that's where we're looking to CDFA and some others to really understand, you know, what agriculture can do and what's an achievable metric that will move us in the direction of reducing fertilizer applications where there is too much being applied, and allowing folks to comply given the, I would say, you know, our region has got variability that's out of this world, right? In the soil types, the climates, and so expecting somebody to meet just one number is going to be very difficult, and I think that's another thing we have to consider. Just first of all, want to, you know, the comments are, we've got these comments down now, and we're going to be thinking about these things as we start to move towards implementation in our program, and as we work on the CV Salts program too.
I think I see that Mr. Kane may be available. Can we double check?
Am I able to be heard?
Yep, we can hear you.
Okay, thank you. I apologize. There was a Zoom phone computer issue. I appreciate the chance to comment, and I'll try to be brief. My name is Nathaniel Kane. I am the Executive Director of Environmental Law Foundation. We submitted a substantial written comment on this acceptable ranges document in the winter last year. I think that document stands on its own, and I would recommend that members of the board review that document. I think that the summary provided earlier failed to adequately capture all the points that were raised in that document. The acceptable ranges report that was submitted by the coalitions, we find highly problematic. If we're serious about reducing nitrogen pollution in this region, and I think we should be serious about that, given the ongoing documented contamination of wells and the ongoing documented overapplication of nitrogen in this region, I think we need to set acceptable ranges at a much lower level. And I think that an interpretation of the Eastern San Joaquin Order that permits essentially ongoing business as usual with an upper bound set at the 75th percentile is completely inconsistent with that order. This acceptable ranges needs to move in the direction of compliance with water quality objectives. I want to join all the comments by Ms. Clary and Ms. Rivers. This upper 75th percentile bound, it just guarantees ongoing contamination. The numbers in this report are extremely high. So what we would request is, as a first step, is to use actual market data, use actual agronomic science, which is not apparent in this report, set that upper bound at an agronomic rate that is economically achievable, have that be transparent, have that be based on data, and have that be the milestone for an initial acceptable range. But it needs to be better supported if we were going to go in that direction. And I think that this board should strongly consider direction to staff to not approve this document as written. Thank you. Thank you for bearing with me through the technical issues. And I appreciate the opportunity to participate here.
All right. Thank you for your comments. I just want to highlight there's no action before the board. This is just an informational item. So I, too, want to echo my appreciation to commenters. I will open it up for board discussion at this point. So
I'll make a quick comment.
Yes, please.
Yeah. I think there's a few challenges. Certainly, this is one of the more contested items covered not only by the East San Joaquin petition, but covered by a 2013 water quality order that the State Board adopted, adjudicating some of the conditions in the Central Coast Ag Order. It's also something that came up in the more recent Central Coast Ag Order as something that will be covered by, or is being covered by, the Agricultural Expert Panel. The appropriate way of setting limits on agricultural producers based off of the data that we're receiving on the applied nitrogen versus the amount that can be removed by the crop is squarely within the purview of that expert panel. And I think across the regions, we have been trying to figure out what the appropriate regulatory standard is. I think acceptable is a tough term to use. It's certainly a term that was used in the East San Joaquin order. And I really do want to emphasize that two things. One, this is a process. I think we have come before you a number of times talking about acceptable ranges, talking about targets, talking about values, because we absolutely understand there is no crop grown with the application of nitrogen fertilizer that can perfectly take up every little bit of nitrogen before it leaves the crop zone. And so the challenge is to figure out what is the appropriate level to be protective now, and to ensure that we are on progress towards meeting water quality objectives. And that really means that what is acceptable, what falls within an acceptable range today, is not necessarily what is regulatorily acceptable years from now. And so, again, keeping that all in mind, this is a process that is designed to ensure compliance with water quality objectives, consistent with the CV Salts project, which would set that final compliance milestone 35 years from the adoption of the exception. So lots of words there. Bottom line, this is a process. This is, as Adam stated, it is a statistical analysis based off of optimal growing conditions and real-world growing conditions, and it is something that the board is taking into account. And we're still trying to figure out how to set limits based off of this available information. It is not going to be chiseled in stone as the regulatory standard that the agricultural community needs to comply with. It is something that we are considering as we move towards compliance over the next 35 years.
Yeah, and I also appreciate that, Patrick. Also, I'd like to note that, what's going to be before us in terms of decisions in the future, it's always about weighing the costs and benefits. And I've said this before, it's difficult. We have obviously nitrate contamination problem. That's a very real problem. It's a legacy problem, but we still have agriculture still needs to have an environment where they can produce food in an efficient manner for a hungry country, for people. We're growing food here. And that's not to say that we should not be applying best practices. Certainly, I'll be looking to the expert panel to help inform these decisions, as well as CDFA. I would like maybe Adam or Patrick to touch on, the relation between each. Adam, you mentioned that CDFA will be commenting back. I mean, certainly as a policy and a decision maker up at this level, I will be looking to experts to help guide that discussion and those decisions. Can you tell us a little bit about how the CDFA review of the acceptable ranges sort of relates to the discussion at the ag panel?
So the ag panel's been asked to look at a number of factors. One of the chief ones is whether or not actual limits, enforceable limits, should be applied to the use of fertilizer. That's a little different than what the acceptable ranges are getting at. But that I believe that, like Patrick said, that process will inform these acceptable ranges, because frankly, the same information would probably be used in deriving those limits if the expert panel is going to push us in that direction. So that's on the one side. So there's going to be they're going to weigh in on that information, how good our information is, the 75th percentile, right? That's something that was brought up today, and things like that. On the other side, CDFA, because our staff we're water quality scientists and engineers. CDFA has agronomists on staff, and so we've spoken with CDFA and asked them if they would do a sort of agency peer review of the actual science that was developed for these acceptable ranges, and whether or not those acceptable ranges are, questions we might ask them is, 75th percentile is the upper bound. Is that, what do you think about that? And things like that. And so I hope to get, we've had an initial conversation with them. They were receptive to doing that work. And I think right now it's a question of how quickly their resources can be brought to bear. And so, yeah, I think that's, if you have questions, I hope I touched on everything.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Okay, at this point, open it up to the board for questions, comments. Otherwise.
Yeah, the only comment I'll make is that Adam, I heard you say that you have taken into consideration the voices of the environmental justice groups and their comments, and all of that is being considered. So as we move through this process, the voices should be all of the voices should be considered. So I look forward to hearing more and how we're addressing that. Thank you.
I guess I would just ask if you have a timeline for peer review from CDFA and the Ag Panel. Where are we on that timeline?
So with CDFA, I don't have a timeline from them yet. I've had affirmative that they will do it. And I need to, there's been some staffing things that I've had to work through there, but I hope to get in touch with them soon. And in fact, I've been meaning to reach out. So I'm sorry, I don't have a timeline for that. I do hope that once we do get it started, my feeling is it's not going to be, you know, a large expert panel process or anything like that. My feeling is that we'd like to, you know, get them to comment on this before the end of the year or in early next year, because of the fact that this information is part of our CV Salts, management zone implementation plan. And we want to make sure that we're moving with the best information possible. But like Patrick said, these are not going to be set in stone. These are not enforceable limits from the perspective of a number that we would be having monetary penalties, things like that. These are targets. These are things that can be fluid and can be changed and can be moved. And that's, I think, the good part about them. And like we spoke about before, I think David brought it up, our permits and orders, that this is one piece. This is a piece that people can look at above ground. We're not looking at models that look at below ground. We're not looking at groundwater data. This is something that someone can say as a grower easily, right? It's not a statistical model, and they're not, it's easily, here's the number I'm shooting for. Here's what I want to shoot for. And so, it's perfection, we'll get there. We're going to get these better and better over time. But having something for them to shoot for is really important.
I think I just want to point something out. I think you used the idea of getting to a perfect scenario. I don't know that we'll ever get to perfect. I think we're all trying to do the best we can given the circumstances. And so, I don't want to set expectations that there's a perfect answer out there. All right. Any other questions or comments?
I've got the perfect answer.
What's that?
I've actually got the perfect answer.
All right, let's hear it.
I will say that I think to answer the other part of your question, the State Board's Agricultural Expert Panel expects to conclude its work in early 2026. There may be additional deliberations by the State Water Board after that. That, again, is focused very much on, we've got these management practice evaluations. We've got these acceptable ranges. Can you set limits? And when can you set limits, I think, are the two questions. The other component I want everybody to be aware of is the process outlined in CV Salts would be for the granting of a 35-year exception. That 35-year exception will consider at regular 5-year intervals the state of technology in the dairy industry, in the agricultural industry, and wastewater treatment, to see if that 35-year timeline is as short as practicable. That will be one of the mechanisms by which this board exercises continuing authority over the ability of the agricultural industry to reduce nitrate loading on a quicker timeline than 35 years. So that's, again, lots of things happening all at once, but just wanted to talk in broad sense about what the timelines are.
Thank you for that. All right, with seeing no other questions, we'll move on from this item. Yep. All right, with that, we're actually up for adjournment. Before we adjourn, I just want to extend my great thanks to Clint and his team up here in Reading, kind of echoing some earlier comments. It was a great field trip yesterday, and what a beautiful time of year and a beautiful part of the state. So I really appreciate the opportunity to just get a little sneak peek into just a little piece of that. So thank you, Clint, and your staff. With that, go ahead.
Just to announce, the next board meeting looks like it will be December 12th, and I think it actually may be set at a 10 a.m. start time. So Just want to let everybody know that
I think that's
that
going to be important for, injured. For so, I think so. Chair Bradford, I think, is a 10 o'clock on the 12th of December.
Are you not?
See, on December 12th, I am serious. I think there may be a conflict with one of us.
All right. I'll have a conversation about it. All right. With that, I'm going to adjourn this meeting at 11:57. Thank you.